has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize a number of times. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Kelly. Kathy Kelly, how are you feeling? You're in the third week of your hunger fast. Talk about why you're usually outside the UN hunger striking.
Well, thank you, Amy and Ramin. Yes, third week. But, you know, we wake up each morning and we don't worry about whether or not our children have been buried under rubble overnight. We're not drinking poisoned water. We're not surrounded by rubble. We're not dealing with the horrible traumas that people in Palestine and Gaza are dealing with. And so we want to take what action we can to encourage, to focus world attention, because the leaders of the world now have an opportunity. It's really an unusual opportunity to press forward beyond yesterday's very, very unfortunate vote, the fifth time the United States has vetoed a Security Council resolution. There is a mechanism called Uniting for Peace, which would allow the General Assembly to bypass a U.S. veto. And the member staffs of the United Nations General Assembly permanent missions understand this mechanism. They really are working hard. But if we all push, as has been happening, we really do see it, don't we, all around the world. I mean, in Ireland, Trinity College, they just severed, because of the student pressure, trade relations with companies and universities in Israel. But what the member states of the United Nations could do now is enact this Uniting for Peace resolution and not just make denunciations, but give it teeth, really implement what has been implemented in the past. I mean, in 1956, the United States worked with the Soviet Union to implement this resolution because they didn't want France and the UK to invade the Suez Canal area. They wanted to have control. So it is doable. The other thing is that the nations of the world ought to recognize that Israel is flaunting international law in so many ways. I mean, possession of nuclear weapons flaunts international law, and Israel has at least 90 thermonuclear weapons stockpiled. And the European Union is now investigating the other horrendous violations of human rights that have been happening. And upcoming is the plan for a two-state solution conference hosted by France and Saudi Arabia. France hasn't even recognized the statehood of Palestine yet. And we're familiar with Saudi Arabia as a predator nation, as one that has been pretty greedy and avaricious in the way that it has taken from the Yemenis and imposed drastic warfare. So what is going to happen? Is it possible that they're going to try to use the United Nations to sort of give a good cover to what might become a collection of Bantustan-like states that would not recognize the Palestinian right to self-return, Palestinian right to self-determination, Palestinian right to survival at this point?
Well, Kathy, of course, as you mentioned, the U.S. vetoed this resolution. They've done so multiple times. What are you calling for now? How long do you intend to continue your hunger strike?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, we're out there for 40 days, so we're just really at the beginning part. We want that Uniting for Peace resolution to be invoked, and it is a mechanism that's possible. We also think that there are plenty of ways that they could give more teeth through using economic trade measures being canceled. The European Union is investigating that, but they can move faster and more firmly so that we give teeth to the denunciations that have been given. And of course, there's much more alliance. The United States is quite isolated. And perhaps within Israel, Israeli people longing for the release of the hostages will start to listen to some of their own reservists who are saying, no, Prime Minister Netanyahu is sabotaging the hostage release and ceasefire possibilities, and they won't go to Gaza. There are 20 waiting to be sentenced, most likely.
How many of you are fasting, and what would lead you to end your fast?
750 worldwide. We're on the corner of 1st Avenue and 45th Street, and right now we are usually about 12 people that are core fasters here in New York, but there are others in Australia. we're hearing from people in China, Ireland, Canada, Mexico. So this is a fast that grew very, very quickly. Phil Tottenham, you know, as Mike said, concerned about the life-risking options. He didn't want to do what Aaron Bushnell did because he said, well, I was afraid to do that. But he said, I can fast. And so that's really what got this going. What would make us stop? Well, certainly if there were a permanent, unconditional, immediate ceasefire and all distribution of aid was being facilitated by the United Nations, which knows how to do it, and the Gaza Human Foundation would not be any longer relied on. They're luring people into food distribution centers and then shooting them in the head, in the torso. And so we want to see the full distribution of food and a complete end to any United States weapon shipments to Israel.
Kathy Kelly, we wish you the very best. Kathy Kelly is board president of World Beyond War, has just entered her third week on a hunger strike. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Earlier today, Israel attacked the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City. It marked the eighth time the hospital has been attacked over the past 600 days. Three Palestinian journalists were killed at the hospital. A fourth journalist was seriously wounded. We turn now to look at how the Israeli medical establishment has responded to Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza's health system.
We're joined now by the co-authors of a new article headlined The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. Joining us in Tel Aviv, in Israel, is the medical anthropologist Guy Shalev, who serves as executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. And in London, the Israeli political scientist Neve Gordon, who is the first director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He's a professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Neve Gordon, let's begin with you. Talk about what you found.
What we found is that the support for Israel's assault on Gaza, the genocidal assault, including the decimation of its medical system, including the killing of 1,400 health workers, including the detention and disappearance of 400 medical doctors and healthcare workers, including the torture of detainees, has been supported by the Israeli medical establishment through and through, whether it's from the top, the Israeli Medical Association, that represents 95% of Israeli doctors, the other healthcare associations, including the Nursing Association and the Psychological Associations and their ethical committees. We found that that hospitals did not accept Palestinian detainees who were wounded and needed medical care. We found that doctors inside hospitals were unwilling to treat Palestinian detainees or did not demand that the shackles from their legs and their arms and their blindfold be removed before they were treated. We found that doctors did not provide painkillers to Palestinians, claiming that they should suffer from the pain. We found doctors in Israeli hospitals that posted genocidal messages on their private social media accounts. We found persecution of medical doctors and nurses, Palestinian medical doctors and nurses in the Israeli establishment. So there's a whole system, the whole medical establishment inside Israel has been actually supporting Israel's assault on the Palestinian people and particularly on its healthcare system.
Now, Guy Shalev, you are joining us from Tel Aviv. You are the executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. It is this organization, your organization, that gathered testimony from 24 of these Palestinian health workers. Can you explain how the testimony was collected? And, you know, the key things, what most surprised you about what you found?
Right. So first of all, it was impossible to collect testimonies for many months since the beginning of the war. In the beginning, there was no access to detainees. We could not send lawyers to visit them. We could not have any kind of supervision of their conditions of how they're being held. After approximately 6 months, we could have started to send lawyers to visit them to collect the testimonies. And then what we heard was just impossible to hear. Doctors that were detained while they were doing their work in hospitals, other doctors who were detained while crossing checkpoints across Gaza after the soldiers found out that they are doctors, and then being taken to facilities in Israel. Most famous, probably infamous, is the Sde Teiman facility, being subjected to torture, medical neglect, violence, starvation. Three doctors and one paramedic died in Israeli facilities. These are four out of the 90 Palestinian detainees who died in the past 20 months. And we tried to figure out what was the reason why doctors were targeted in such a way. And we realized that in their investigations, they were asked to provide information or kind of reveal the structure of hospitals and what they know, which is a violation of the international law and protection of medical workers. You cannot detain a medical worker for the purpose of collecting information if you don't have any evidence that they violated any law. And in fact, most of these people were held without a trial, without charges. Many of them are still held, approximately 150 medical personnel are still held in Israeli detention facilities.
And Guy Shalev, you also point to an extraordinary statistic regarding the number of Palestinians who work in the Israeli medical establishment. You say Palestinians comprise 25% of all doctors and almost 50% of all new doctors and nurses in Israel. So can you explain how they have been treated in the months since October 7th, these Palestinians who work in Israeli hospitals?
Right. And yes, first of all, these are amazing numbers. And this is the outcome of a long process of many years of Palestinians studying medicine, both in Israel and abroad, and choosing medicine as their kind of profession for the reasons that many people in the world choose that profession, but also for the reason that many minorities and people of marginal communities choose medicine, because they see that as an opportunity for social mobility, an opportunity to be accepted as equal. And that is why we see a lot of doctors in the Israeli medical system. And unfortunately, this ideal of a system that is that considers them as equal was never a reality, and definitely not after October 7, when there was basically a witch hunt of Palestinian medical workers in the Israeli system. Social media profiles were scanned to see whatever they are posting there. And then a very large number of doctors and medical workers were subjected to hearings and other kind of processes, including firing doctors and medical workers for just the most basic social media posts, such as supporting children in Gaza, or just feeling compassion for the people of Gaza. It created this atmosphere that basically silenced and censored an entire group of doctors and medical workers in the Israeli system.
We're speaking with two of the three authors of the piece, The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. We're speaking with the medical anthropologist Guy Shalev in Tel Aviv, and with Niamh Gordon, professor, speaking to us from London. The third author is Dr. Osama Tanous, a pediatrician board member of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He was advised by his lawyers not to do the interview. Guy Shalev, can you explain why?
Yes, this is exactly what we just talked about. It is just too risky for a Palestinian citizen of Israel to be publicly resisting the war, publicly criticizing the Israeli establishment. And we've seen cases, for example, Professor Nader Ashalhoub, a very famous professor in the Hebrew University, who participated, was interviewed in a podcast and was later had to resign from the university for very basic kind of critical opinions, professional critical opinions she had over the Israeli policies in Gaza. So the risk is unfortunately high, and we're sorry that his voice is silenced once again, because Niv and I are here and Osama is not.
And Professor Niv Gordon, if you could say, what exactly are you calling for?
Well, I think what we managed to show in the article is the complicity of the Israeli medical establishment with Israel's egregious violations of international law, including the Genocide Convention. And what we also know from past experience and from what we detail in the article is that change will not emerge from within without pressure from without. And so what we think, or at least I think, is that the international medical establishment and medical community needs to put pressure on their counterparts in Israel in order that they raise their voice against Israel's policies. The Israeli medical establishment in general identifies with Israel's colonial project and puts the colonial project over the most basic ethical principles of their profession. And that, we think, needs to change. So one very practical idea is that students and staff in research institutions in the United States, Canada, in the UK, in Europe, map the kinds of partnerships their institutions have with Israeli medical institutions, with Israeli research teams, with Israeli medical corporations, and demand from their own institutions to cut these partnerships, to cut ties with these partnerships, to end the contracts with Israeli medical corporations, not as a principle, but as a strategy, saying to their Israeli counterparts, we'll be happy to carry out these partnerships again, we'll be happy to do business, but only after Israel stops its colonial project, after the Palestinians receive liberation and self-determination. It is time, we think, that the international community boycott the Israeli establishment in order to bring about change and to stop this genocide we're witnessing.
Niv Gordon, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political scientist, the first director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He's professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London, speaking to us from London. And Guy Shalev, executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. We'll link to your new article, The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. Next up, we go to the British journalist Carol Cadwalader, talking about taking on the Broligarchy. Back in 20 seconds.
History's not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine-robed men or billionaires. billionaires or bankers. It's not made by them. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. I might throw a little money around, wondering who can be bought. Some might find they're cheaper, and some stronger than they thought.
Black Spartacus Heart Attack Machine by Tom Morello here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with the award-winning investigative journalist Carol Cadwalader, who is covering one of the key issues of our time, taking on what she calls the broligarchy, the new age of tech bro oligarchs. Cadwalader gained international recognition for her expose on the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal in 2018. She worked for The Guardian and Observer at the time.
Carol Cadwalader now runs the Substack, How to Survive the Broligarchy. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's quite some time for you to be here in the United States. Mm. You'd usually be in London. You see what's happening in Congress right now, where they're talking about keeping AI, the state's hands off AI, states in the United States for 10 years. And you also see the leaders of AI in this country, including Elon Musk, as basically, in some ways, running this country. How do you take on the broligarchy, and why do you think that's important?
Because I think, you know, we understand how government works. We understand how power works. I mean, this is so much the subject of your show. State power is, you know, that is how the world works. But what has happened is there has been an alternative center of power that has grown up, and that is Silicon Valley. And basically, over a very, very short period of time, they have amassed a huge amount of knowledge and therefore power over us, over the entire population of the world. And they've done that because they gave us things that, you know, we thought we wanted. You know, they gave us great products, great services, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Google search. But now what we're seeing is that these companies with this huge amount of knowledge about every aspect of our lives are now allying themselves with the US government, with what we can see is an authoritarian regime. I mean, I hesitate to use that word, but that is what the US is becoming. And now this is a new type of power, and this is, the world hasn't seen this before, in which you have state power now with this enormous surveillance engine machine, which is Silicon Valley. And it's the coming together of these two things, which I think is a totally terrifying new reality that you are experiencing first in the US here, but actually other authoritarian countries have already, they're ahead of you in some ways, and this is now spreading across the world.
I mean, in fact, you make an analogy in your TED talk in April, just earlier this year, between what's happened in Russia and what's happening now in the U.S., and you warn these tech bros, saying that, you know, you cannot ally yourself with an autocrat, believing that you will be protected. So if you could elaborate on that and how you see this analogy working, I mean, the business elite allied with, as you said, autocrats elsewhere, and what form you see it taking here.
So I think you're in the U.S., you're in a more vulnerable, a more vulnerable position even than people in Russia. Because, so what we saw when Putin took power, there was initially, he let the oligarchs, he let this business elite, he let them alone, like, make money and I will leave you alone. I'm going to, you know, that you're going to have the power to build, you know, through massive illegality and corruption to grow these vast, enormous amounts of wealth. But then came the crackdown, and he increasingly, if they didn't do exactly what he wanted, if they didn't support him in every way, well, then they suffered for it. And in cases, you know, this guy, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, he Putin fell out with him and exiled him to Siberia for a decade. You know, another oligarch, Boris Berezovsky, you know, he was killed in mysterious circumstances. So this idea that the leaders of these tech companies, you know, think that by sucking up and cozying up to Trump, that it's all going to be golden, they're just going to make vast fortunes, I think that, I hope they see as an erroneous belief. But also, I think, for the American people, is that these were just business leaders in the U.S. What is different in Russia? What is different in the U.S. is that these are companies which are integrated into all of our lives. And so that, for me, is the thing which is profoundly, profoundly troubling, which is you have the machinery of a surveillance society, which is now being, as I say, enmeshed with this increasingly authoritarian government.
So talk about, I mean, with Cambridge Analytica, which you helped expose, they were providing information to Brexit, and you would ultimately be sued by one of the financiers. The vice president was Steve Bannon, who is a key ally of President Trump. Now here in the United States, you've got Palantir. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the Trump administration tapping this data mining company founded by the billionaire tech investor like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, South African, to compile data on people in the United States for a master database, and why this is so dangerous.
So I think, you know, what was the good thing, if I can say this, about Elon Musk, is that he made the threat from these Silicon Valley companies visible for the first time. We now know who Elon Musk is. We now know how dangerous he is. And I think we now have to go through the same process with understanding who this guy, Peter Thiel, is, and this company, Palantir. And one thing to know is that Peter Thiel and Elon Musk were business partners. They go way back. They actually founded PayPal together, which is, you know, the online money transfer system. There is a small bunch of people who have, with very similar ideas, essentially been on this power grab. And what we have seen happen in the last few months is a rapid, an unaccountable and illegal harvesting of different, DOGE went into different government offices, and in, you know, we saw it in the US Treasury first. That was an illegal access to those computers, at which point DOGE took that data. Now, that pattern has been repeated in departments across the federal government. New York Times said, I think it was 314 different databases which were taken. That has now been merged together, and now Palantir is being brought in. So Palantir, the first thing you should know about it, you've just been watching these incredible reports from about Gaza and Palestine. Palantir is a military contractor. It is being used by the Israeli government to find people, to profile them, to pick out targets and to eliminate them. And the CEO of Palantir, a guy called Alex Karp, has said that out loud. He said, this is what we do. He said, when necessary, we kill people. That is now the company that is in the heart of the US federal government. That is the company now which has the data of every citizen in this country. And I think, you know, people should be freaked out, okay? If you're not freaking out yet, you should be. Because this, we have seen there is a pattern across history, across the world, which is this is what authoritarians do. They want as much information about the population as possible so that they can surveil them, they can control them, they can search out their enemies, they can target them, and they can punish them, and they can silence them. That process has already started in the US, and we see it in the US amongst the most vulnerable population. We see it happening to immigrants. We see it happening to foreign students. Now, that is just the test case, because these are the people with the fewest rights. But what happens to them is now going to come to other people.
We're going to do part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Carol Cadwalader, award-winning investigative journalist, her Substack, How to Survive the Broligarchy. And we will link to her pieces, The Dark Lord of Silicon Valley. Peter Thiel enters the chat. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
that a normal part of your singing?
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.